This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today we are talking about birds and rats and what is killing them. A bald eagle died at a veterinary hospital on the Cape last week, and the suspected cause of death? Professional-grade rat poison. Not an isolated incident, either. Last month at Faneuil Hall, an owl nicknamed Owen fell ill after being exposed to a type of blood-thinning poison that is called second-generation anticoagulant rodenticides. And there is an acronym, ESCARS. Zach Mertz is CEO of the New England Wildlife Center. He's part of a push to better track the use of ESCARS in Massachusetts. Joins us now in Studio 2. Welcome, Zach.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I want to start with this Arlington eagle. So the eagle died on the Cape. It was nesting and had hunted in Arlington. And tell us what we think happened to the eagle and how the town reacted.
Sure. So this is a very well-known eagle known as MK. And her mate, Kazier, frequented the Mystic River watershed for years. And, you know, just being in such a central location, they've attracted a lot of fans and a lot of bird watchers, and people follow them pretty closely. And so I guess it was last week, we get a call that MK was not feeling so well. She was down on the ground, and some local folks had captured her and transferred her to our hospital. And, you know, so we took in MK, and our veterinary team at the New England Wildlife Centers looked her over. Could see she was really weak, lethargic, unable to lift her head. And so in an effort to try to stabilize her and figure out what was going on, we also drew some blood, did our diagnostics. And our going theory and what we suspect is that there was some exposure to these ESCARS or anticoagulant rat poisons. You know, and when they get into the body of an eagle like that or a hawk or an owl or a fox or whatever it may be, they thin the blood and they make it, you know, really hard for the body to clot normally. And so it can turn something as simple as a bump or bruise or scrape into a catastrophic injury. And so poor MK is, you know, was affected by this. And we did our best to save her. But unfortunately, she did not make it.
And the town has really responded.
Yes, there's been an incredible outpouring of support, not just for MK, but for better reporting on ESCARS and maybe even a ban on ESCARS in the state. You know, as I mentioned, she was really well-loved in the Boston area. And so a lot of people were familiar with her and even felt some ownership over her habitats and sort of life because they've been photographing her and tracking her. So the folks at Arlington specifically really showed up and you know, voiced their concern for not just MK, but for the wildlife in general.
So we have this fascinating situation, Zach, where we've got the beloved and the reviled, right?
Yeah.
And a poison being used on the reviled, which is our rat population, and having this potential impact on the beloved, which in this case is MK, the eagle. How did we get to the point where we are using these things called ESCARS? And my understanding is that they're fairly widely used commercially as a preferred approach to killing rats.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, humans and rats have coexisted for thousands of years. As long as we've been, you know, living inside homes, rats have probably been a problem and truthfully can be a public health concern for anyone living in a home. You don't want a huge rat population because it can affect your health or your family's health. And so there's always been this push and pull struggle to control them. And, you know, as the rat populations grew and the different methods evolved, we've found ourselves now using these second-generation anticoagulant rodenticides, or ESCARS. And they're in use because they're cheap and effective.
And they take a while to kill the rat, which means something that eats that rat while it's got the poison in its body is also ingesting the poison.
Exactly. And so these are reasonably slow acting in the world of poisons, meaning 3 to 5 days on average for a rat to die. So
isn't that cruel?
You know, it's probably not the best way to go, honestly. But, you know, there's a reason behind it, and that's that folks don't want a rat or mouse dying in their walls and smelling up the house. And so oftentimes, you know, these guys get sick. They're not feeling well. They sort of scoot out of the house or look for shelter. And you have a hawk or an owl or, you know, in this case, we suspect an eagle thinking they have a really easy lunch right in front of them. A sick, slow-moving animal doesn't take a lot of energy to catch. And all of a sudden, the predator has ingested the poison as well. And in a lot of cases, what we see happen is, you know, the hawk or owl or whatever it is, they're not feeling well now because their blood's not clotting efficiently. And so they can't hunt effectively. And so the next mouse or rat they can afford to catch, maybe another sick one. And you see this.
So this compounds.
Exactly. So you see a cycle of poisoning and dosing and redosing. So we're not sure if that's what happened in MK's case, but it's certainly something we've witnessed before.
We're talking with Zach Mertz of the New England Wildlife Center about this tension between approaches to poisoning and killing rats and animals that ingest those rats while they're dying and then get poisoned and killed themselves. I want to come back to the eagles for a minute because I think, you know, many are aware the bald eagles were endangered. They're, you know, the U.S. bird, they were endangered. In New England, it came from DDT, was a big cause of the death of birds. But there had been a rebound. As of 2018, according to Mass Wildlife, 76 territorial pairs of bald eagles were identified in Massachusetts. Before 2012, they had been endangered. Now they're just special concern in the state. Are we talking about something that could be a threat to the rebounding of the eagle population?
I mean, so we've seen a pretty incredible conservation effort by Mass Wildlife to bring the population back. And, you know, as a Charles and Mystic, as our environments have improved, we see a pretty robust eagle population, which is super encouraging. I mean, anything like this that, you know, can go through a population and we know is reasonably ubiquitous, I think can be a threat. But realize eagles, you know, their primary food source is fish. When you get an eagle that overlaps with an urban setting, you know, they may eat mice or rats like we're starting to see. But we're hoping that this particular poison isn't so much an issue for the eagle populations, but it is something we see constantly, week in, week out, with owls and hawks and fox. A lot of things
coyotes?
Coyotes as well. Yeah, anything that would make a lunch out of a mouse or rat, and, you know, they're solidly down there at the bottom of our food chain, can get sick from this stuff. And unfortunately, what's happening is we're taking nature's best rodent control, right? You know, say a great horned owl can probably eat 2,000 mice in a year, and we're making that animal sick. And so instead of working in concert with nature to control rodents and you know, utilizing these animals that are out there doing the job for us, we're unfortunately using a method that can make them sick and set us back as well.
So you want there to be a bill, a law. You want to pass a law.
Right now, we've been working on a law that was put forth by Representative Hawkins, and we see it as a good first step. And it's really aimed at improving the reporting and data sharing around how much of this poison is being used, where it's being used, and who can access it, right? So the first step is we want researchers and decision makers and scientists to have a good understanding of where this stuff is being put out and then be able to correlate that to the things we're seeing in our hospitals and other rehabbers are seeing. And our hope is this, you know, starts the momentum and then eventually maybe something more aggressive like California has tried.
So that's Democrat Jim Hawkins out of Attleboro. I want to play a little sound for you. This is from Leo Bauscher, formerly of Boston Inspectional Services. We talked to him about the rat population last year. Here he is.
All the rats need are food and water. They don't need anything extravagant. It doesn't have to be spring water. And it doesn't have to be filet mignon. You know, any type of food refuse, any type of water, puddles, stagnant water, things of that nature will suffice as a food source.
So, I mean, could coordinating with the natural predators be enough? This is like a Terminator, right? Just bam, bam, bam. Could it work?
You know, I think we have to use every tool in our toolbox, honestly. And so leaving the natural predators healthy and out there doing the job they do, I think is a great step because, you know, here in Boston especially, we have wildlife all in our backyard and surrounding us. The hawks, the owls, the foxes, anything that makes use of our land is going to help us in the issue. And certainly, you know, the rats are an issue too. And to his point there, I think one of the best things we can do is make sure that we're you know, making sure trash bins are sealed up, we're using integrated pest management solutions. And when we choose a poison, make sure you're using one that isn't going to affect the other wildlife out there that are trying to help us in the battle.
Perfect. Zach Mertz is CEO of New England Wildlife Center. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Today, the mystery of a regional dish with what seems like an incongruous name, Chinese pie. It's a staple meal in homes all across Quebec, Canada. Producer Amanda Beland grew up eating this dish with her French-Canadian family in New Hampshire, and she always wondered about the name. As part of our podcast series Last Seen, she went looking for the answers. And here's part one of that show. Producer Nora Sachs takes it from here.
Have you ever noticed how food has a way of being claimed? Chicago has its deep dish pizza, and then there's New Orleans with the po' boy, and New Jersey's pork roll. Or Taylor ham, depending on who you ask, I guess.
Totally. But for my French-Canadian family, nothing beats a Chinese pie, which is a layered casserole of ground beef, corn, and mashed potatoes on top. It kind of looks like a shepherd's pie, but it's not.
Shepherd's pie, I know. Chinese pie, I don't. But you're a WBUR producer, and isn't that something that your family has eaten for generations?
Yes, but we're not the only ones.
It's very intimate. It's something that you eat here from childhood to the end of your life. It's very, very common.
That's Fabien Deglise. He's a journalist for the Montreal newspaper Le Devoir. Chinese pie, or pâté de chinois as they call it there, is so popular that in 2007, Le Devoir named it the unofficial national dish of Quebec. Deglise says it's so popular that most households cook it. There's even TV shows about it.
And one of the characters tried to recall the recipe of pâté chinois. She said, ground beef, corn, potatoes. No, potatoes, corn, ground beef.
Steak, bledain, patate. Repeat after me.
Steak, bledain, patate.
And that was very funny because there are no recipe for pâté chinois.
You're kidding me. No recipes?
That's right, there's no recipes. But despite this national obsession, no one, I mean no one, knows where it comes from.
Probably if I find the real origin of pâté chinois, I would get the Nobel Prize. And I would be very proud of that.
Welcome to Last Scene, a show about people, places, and things that have gone missing. From WBUR, Boston's NPR station, I'm Nora Sachs. Now, when it comes to Chinese pie, it's not clear if this dish even comes from Quebec, or Canada for that matter. And that's been eating at WBUR producer Amanda Beland. So today, she's taking on the mystery of the dish with the unusual name, and in the process, discovers a whole lot more than just its origin story. This is Chinese pie.
On the night I turned 33, I was staring at a computer screen. On it was my family tree, documented for me by my partner Elio on Ancestry. I always had some curiosity in the back of my mind about my heritage, but never had any real facts about where I came from. That all changed that night. Turns out, I'm about as French-Canadian as a person can be. And with that change came more curiosity about a dish I grew up eating, the one with the unusual name. It was a name I thought only my family used, one that I wondered if I should say so loudly in public. In Quebec, that unusual name is pâté chinois. Technically, pâté chinois translates to China pie or Chinese pie, depending on who you ask. And that's what my grandparents called it, according to my dad.
Pâté chinois.
Yep. They did?
Yeah.
So interesting.
I know, and I didn't remember that till you said it. And then it rang a bell that, yeah, that's why the meme used to call it, and Pepe, too.
My grandparents, my meme and Pepe, were Franco-American. They lived in Manchester, New Hampshire, a once-bustling mill town on the Merrimack River.
So Pepe, okay, Pepe, give you a kiss.
There.
That's them right there. This is taken from a home video, recorded when I was a baby. I also grew up in Manchester, so did my dad. My mom grew up in a neighboring town called Goffstown, but we're all part of the roughly 2 million people living in New England who claim French-Canadian heritage and Chinese pie or pâté chinois.
Meme made it all the time, and Mom made it often enough, but not that often because you didn't care for it.
I definitely didn't like vegetables as a kid.
Yeah, we would have it. It would be like a pretty quick meal. You know, Mom would make some mashed potatoes and then, you know, fry the hamburger and then take the corn.
But it wasn't just my parents. A lot of us Quebecers, including my extended family, ate Chinese pie.
I think all of Meme's sisters made it also. you know, Aunt B and Aunt Irene and Aunt Elaine. And I think my Uncle Rudy liked it. So I know they used to eat it. So I think they all used to make it. So they must have got that from my grandmother.
That's how Chinese pie spreads from generation to generation, mother to daughter. My mom got her recipe from my grandmother, and I got mine from my mom. It's made in restaurants, but not often. And when it is, it's mostly in Quebec. No other province in Canada claims pâté de chinois like Quebecers do. And it's mostly kept within families and neighbors, documented through recipe cards, but more often through word of mouth.
You have all of Meme's recipe cards, right?
I do. I looked around at them and there isn't a recipe I could find in there for Chinese pie.
This is partly why the origin of Chinese pie is a mystery. And it's that mystery that inspired food historian Jean-Pierre Lemesson to write an entire book called The Unfathomable Mystery of Chinese Pie. In it, he looks for a clear origin for the dish and the name, but finds none, except to confirm it belongs to Quebec.
One of the interests of that book, in my opinion, is that destroy all explanation about the origin of pâté chinois, prove that every current explanation are wrong, but I am unable to prove what is a good history.
As I see it, there are two known unknowns here. One, where does the dish come from? And two, what's up with that name? Both histories are tied together, but I'm going to explore each separately. First, let's dig into the history of the dish, which I think will lay the foundation for the name. As Jean-Pierre writes in his book,
N'est-ce pas là un étrange paradoxe d'être à la fois tous unis dans la
même... Isn't it a strange paradox to be both united in the same love of taste and also united in the ignorance of its history? Many Quebecers are also united in that same ignorance and history, one that Canadian musician Gordon Lightfoot knows well.
There was a time in this fair land when the railroad did not run, when the wild majestic mountains stood alone against the sun.
Here's how the legend goes. Pâté chinois was created during the construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway. Chinese-Canadian railway workers made the dish during construction. White Canadian workers adopted the recipe and named it after them. Seems almost too perfect, doesn't it? That white and Chinese laborers were just out there, working on the railroad, trading favorite recipes? I didn't quite buy it, so I started digging into the facts. And when I did, the legend began to fall apart.
Like I said, I've never heard of this. This is an interesting story.
That's Paul Yi, a historian and author of Chinese history in Canada, including the building of the Canadian Pacific Railway.
So the grand mystery to me is what the Chinese connection is, because in terms of ingredients, not so great. In terms of, you know, cultural history or culinary history, no connection either.
The construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway began in 1881 and lasted for 4 years. Roughly 15,000 Chinese workers were hired for the project. The majority of them built the western leg of the railway through the Canadian Rockies in British Columbia. Few worked in the province, now known as Quebec. Little information exists about the Chinese railroad worker experience, but what's documented shows they didn't eat very well. Rice was a staple for them, yet many suffered and died from malnutrition. Bing Chow is a descendant of these railway workers and spoke with them and others about their experiences building the railroad.
They were working in a very primitive condition, in the middle of nowhere, in the bush. If they can plant something during the summer, they got some fresh vegetable. Otherwise, they were eating preserved meat, frozen meat.
Chow is a member of the group called Foundation to Commemorate the Chinese Railroad Workers in Canada. He's also never heard of pâté chinois or its connection to the railway. Still, there's something else happening in Canada and in the U.S. that's crucial to this theory, says Paul Yi.
Living in that early period was overshadowed by huge amounts of white racism because the Chinese were not wanted. at all in Canada.
When construction wrapped on the first leg of the railroad, Canada instituted its first head tax. This forced Chinese immigrants in Canada to pay an annual fee for living in the country. Canada would raise that tax two more times before passing the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1923. Bing Chao says of the more than 15,000 Chinese brought in to build the railroad, roughly a quarter died in its construction.
If they fell into the valley or whatever, they don't look for them. And they just leave them there to die, like an animal. Because at the time, the white people, for some reason, they hated the Chinese so much. Even after the Chinese, they were dead, they don't let them bury in Canada. At night, they dug up their body and threw them out.
Chow describes a photo taken when the last spike was driven into the ground in 1885. He says as you look at the image, all you see are white workers.
They don't want the people to know the Chinese contribution. The reason is very obvious. The racism. There's a systematic racism in the Canadian community.
Canada's Exclusion Act was eventually repealed in 1947. And in subsequent decades, the Canadian government would include Chinese immigrants in the political and social fabric of Canada and recognize their past contributions to the country. Still, why would a country's workers with documented and persistent racism against the Chinese name a dish in their honor? It doesn't make sense at all. Couple that with the location of the Chinese workers and the ingredients available to them, I think we can count this theory out. Thanks, Gordon Lightfoot.
But time has no beginnings and history has no bounds. As to this verdant country, they came from all around.
Okay, so aside from the we've been working on the railroad theory, there are many, many more about the origin of this dish. It seems like everyone has a favorite or two. Montreal journalist Fabien Deglise says a meat and rice casserole inspired the dish and the name. It could be linked to a cone-shaped strainer called a chinois, or tied to Chinese domestic workers who may have made it for their white bosses. Some say it comes from China, a small town in Maine. Those believers say the dish was created by French Canadians living in the area. Seemed plausible, so I reached out to the Friends of China Maine group on Facebook to see if anyone knew of or made Chinese pie. Dozens of people responded, and as I scrolled through those comments, it was clear there was a common theme.
I made one today with corn, and that's the only way we've ever made shepherd's pie.
French Canadian heritage here also. I've never heard it called Chinese pie or pâté chinois. We called it shepherd's pie, always.
My 76-year-old French-Canadian dad still makes this all the time. And we've always called it pâté chinois, or shepherd's pie too, I guess.
I grew up with it, called shepherd's pie, and continue to make it.
And this set me on a new culinary path about where the dish comes from. Tons of cultures have potato and meat pies, but there are only two that resemble Chinese pie. Shepherd's pie is traditionally lamb or mutton, peas or carrots, and potatoes. And then there's cottage pie, made with beef and just potatoes. Both are from the British Isles.
People argue about it over here a lot. I mean, you do get purists who say, absolutely not. A cottage pie has to involve beef, and a shepherd's pie, obviously, it's all in the name, it's lamb.
That's Annie Gray, an author and food historian specializing in British food history. If people are making a dish with beef, corn, and potatoes and calling it shepherd's pie or cottage pie, could Chinese pie just be an adaptation of those that caught on among the wider French-Canadian community? It's possible, says Gray. Canada became a British colony following the French and Indian War, and both shepherd's and cottage pies were ubiquitous in Britain by the 19th century.
Cultures always collide. Cultures always interact with each other. French Canadians always had connections with British Canadians, and British Canadians always had connections with Americans. And so there always would have been this sort of constant loop.
And the ingredients, potatoes and beef, were also widely available throughout Canada, specifically braised beef, which some older Quebecers use instead of ground meat in the dish. Corn has also long been a major crop in Quebec, called bledain there, meaning Indian wheat.
So it's not surprising to me that all of these kind of elements would come together. And people might go, okay, you know, I've heard about this recipe from my parents, or actually, oh, I met these British fishermen, or Scottish fishermen, as they almost certainly would be, and they were doing this thing, and they called it a shepherd's pie, and that's kind of cool but weird. So let's Frenchify this, as we would with anything.
I talk to a lot of food historians, and one of the things they can all agree on is that change in food is super common. Dishes are always evolving, and ingredients are always being swapped out based on preference. In a sense, that is the only thing constant in food history.
You know, we codify things, but we do not invent them.
So food changes, but it still doesn't explain one of the things I find fascinating about Chinese pie, which is how prevalent it is among the French-Canadian and Franco-American communities. How does it become so tied to Quebec culture? I think it takes a dash of innovation and a global event like World War I.
The fate of the nation and the safety of the world will be decided on the western battlefront of Europe.
After the U.S. enters the war, there's a push by a new federal agency called the United States Food Administration to change eating habits.
They were encouraging everybody that it was your patriotic duty to support those on the front line by just shifting how you cook.
This is Laura Vogt, a curator of the National World War I Museum and Memorial in Kansas City, Missouri. This shift that she's talking about encouraged eating less wheat. This was so the grain could be sent to the troops overseas. Instead, there were government posters and cookbooks pushing another ingredient.
And at the very top, it says, corn, the food of the nation, served some way every meal, appetizing, nourishing, economical. And it shows a woman who's using cornmeal and grits and hominy.
People in the U.S. and Canada were being encouraged to save the wheat. At the same time, both countries' views of food change considerably. The study of nutrition and what people are eating becomes important. Commercial canning is hitting its peak, and one of the canning industry's earliest hubs is in New England, and it's mostly corn. This is where we get back to French Canadians, who are now migrating from Quebec to New England to work in the mills. And it's in this sea of change that corn becomes more prevalent.
There was this encouragement to be using it in a variety of different recipes, to be using it in really creative ways, and very likely encourages folks to add what wasn't, you know, traditional to a shepherd's pie, but throwing a little extra corn certainly wouldn't be a bad thing.
All of this makes sense and certainly explains how corn showed up to the party. But it still leaves me with a big mystery. Where does the name Chinese pie come from?
We'll continue following producer Amanda Beelan and her search for answers. That's coming up tomorrow in part two of this broadcast of Last Scene, the truth about Quebec's most famous and mysterious pie. Most of you probably don't know exactly what that sound is, but I'm guessing at least a few of you recognize it. It's pickleball, and despite being invented in the 1960s, it has experienced a bit of a rebirth through the pandemic. In 2021, 5 million Americans said they played pickleball at least once. Just 1 year later, that number jumped to more than 36 million people. And for some folks, it is serious business.
Yeah, Wes Gabrielson has gotten Ernie twice. So he's not going that flat anymore. Wow, and Eric Lang right there. What a finish. And that hands battle with Duvillier. Able to get up off the ground and finish that forehand.
I was writing Pickleball is Life, which of course is the name of the book because that is my true belief.
Sound there from the 2022 USA Pickleball National Championships, followed by Aaron McHugh, author of, as you just heard, Pickleball is Life. With the sport sweeping the nation and being a former tennis player, I was intrigued, to say the least. So I met up with Erin, who calls herself a missionary for the sport, at PKL in South Boston to learn more.
It's not life exactly, but it's possibly my life.
Yeah, well, there we go, right? And this is the point, right? No one thing is life, except sometimes things draw us in.
That's right.
And they become our obsession.
I grew up here in the South Coast of Massachusetts, and I moved to New York for 42 years, where I used to play tennis, and I seem to have sat down for the whole 42 years I was there. And I came back, and there was a tennis court behind me, and I kept thinking, I don't know that I'm up to playing tennis again, but now I would like to, here I am, sort of in the country, I'd like to be getting out there. And somebody introduced me to pickleball. They said, a bunch of us getting together this afternoon with this game called pickleball. I said, what is that? And she told me what she knew. She said, so-and-so is going to take us out. She knows some of the rules. I went, all right, well, let's try it. So we did, and everybody loved it. And then we started trying to, like, get together, you know. So as still happens today, but more so 3 or 4 years ago when I started, you are scouting every place you can find
to play.
If you can find an old mall parking lot, you're bringing over your chalk and your portable net and your tape, which of course I always have in my trunk anyway. And so it started to get that, you know, I'd be playing once a week, twice a week, whatever. And then came COVID.
Yeah.
And as you may have read, COVID made the sport grow exponentially. And it's because you think of all those families that were living in their little hub together, you know, somebody and their parents and the grandchildren, and imagine how they're driving each other crazy. And they realized they could go outside and do this together.
Yeah, our backdoor neighbors live sort of at the end of a road, right? The road dead ends there. And they drew a pickleball court during COVID on the end of the road. And it's a family of four, and they just played pickleball.
That's right. You had your eye out the window, didn't you?
Well, it's where our kitchen is. Like, yeah. You're standing in the kitchen doing the dishes, and they're having a blast out there playing pickleball. Yeah.
It's very funny. It's very goofy. It's a little dopey, but loads of fun. And so we found a place, actually, right in the tennis court back of my house, and it was owned by the Quakers next door. And I said, do you think we could put up a portable court? Why not? They said. So off we went. And
so let me stop you right there for a second to understand. Is a pickleball court the same size as a tennis court?
No.
Is it smaller? So you have to shrink a tennis court to play pickleball.
It's about a quarter of the size. So you could do it sideways, you could shrink it, whatever,
yeah,
and put up a portable net and draw the line. So it's 20 feet by 44 feet.
Okay.
So, you know, you can find a lot of places that are only that big. This is, of course, what makes it a lot easier on people if you have a bad shoulder, if you have a bad knee or hip or whatever. The size of the court and the sort of accessibility of play in that area is so much easier.
So to that end, in the descriptions that I have read of it, it regularly gets compared to a cross-section of tennis, badminton, and ping pong or table tennis.
That's right.
And so when I read that, I think, okay, sort of tennis rules, kind of, although I think not entirely. Badminton, meaning nobody's going to get hit in the throat with a ball or something. And so is it dangerous?
You know, you try not to hit anybody above the head. Below that is fair game.
It's fair game. All right, so a little more violent than badminton. And table tennis, because it's a more of a short twitch speed reflex, faster game.
I think that's probably right. Anyway, during COVID, what happened is finally, you know, we stayed off the court for a while, and then it just got too hard. And during the time where it was, you'll all remember, it was really, really, really scary, and all you did was sit in your house and think about it.
Yeah.
We went outside. At first, we tried to wear a mask. That lasted 3 minutes. But for a long time, we would sanitize the balls before and after. You know, we were trying to be careful, thinking, well, we're going to be outside and 6 feet away from each other.
What is the ball? Is it a hard ball?
It's a wiffle ball.
It's a wiffle ball.
It was originally a wiffle ball in 1965 when the sport was invented, and it stayed pretty much a wiffle ball.
Okay.
You'll see. And when we would go outside and play, which then became more and more often in this really scary time of COVID, you couldn't believe how you could forget what was going on in the world for an hour and a half and laugh, which you were beginning to think you would not do again. And it really, you'll ask anybody and they'll say it saved them if they played pickleball during that. It really was a huge mental help.
How many years have you been playing pickleball?
I think four now for me.
So it is fairly new still for you.
Fairly new still for me, but you know, if you said about how many hours I play.
Well, that's the next question.
Yeah.
Let me just put it this way. How many days of the week are you on a pickleball court?
Here are my druthers. I play every day.
Yeah.
I prefer to play twice a day. Now and again, I play three times a day, but then the visiting nurse has to come over and pry me off the couch so I can make a little pasta for myself.
Is it the back, the shoulders, the elbows?
It's the being 70, I think.
Yeah.
At that point at PKL, it was time to meet the competition. Aaron and I were set to take on a couple of Susans, Susan Donahue and Susan Cronin. They play with Aaron regularly near their homes in southern Massachusetts, and they are no joke. I started with Susan Donahue. She is a former high-level collegiate tennis player. And I asked her what brought her to pickleball.
A rotator cuff surgery. To be honest, I was a little bit snobby about pickleball. I've taken it up more recently, in no small part because Aaron finally pestered me into going out and trying it.
Yeah.
I had rotator cuff surgery and have been having trouble getting back to tennis, but was losing my mind sitting around. And so Aaron dragged me out. I tried it and I said, not bad, kind of fun. But, you know, as I said to my husband the other night, it's kind of a metaphor for life. Anybody can pick it up and just do it. Turns out it's hard to do it well.
To do it well.
So you have to make a decision. Do you care?
Mm-hmm. And how long into it did you decide you cared?
I'm still debating.
Okay.
Because it's hard to get good.
Okay. I would think. I mean, one of the great frustrations, and I'll turn to you on this, Susan Cronin, former very serious semi-pro softball player, spent a long time in the athletic apparel industry, sort of in the world. When I see people play wiffle ball, one of the things that I think is I do not have the patience to watch a plastic ball fly all over the place and not even know where it's going to go. What I loved about years and years of tennis is I know that with a certain stroke, right, and a certain angle of the racket and a certain orientation of my hips and my belly and my shoulders, I know where the ball is going to go. Is pickleball like that, or badminton, Scott, is my witness, that shuttlecock thing, I don't know where it's going.
No, I think it's a lot like that.
Okay.
I think what Susan's saying here about you got to determine, is it going to be fun or where you're going to take it? Like anything else, I took it up when I retired, and I'm a golfer, so the summertime is busy, but in the winter, what do? I am thrilled to have found pickleball.
How many winters have you been playing?
This is my first one, so I started last, it'll be a year this March. So.
Believe me, you'd never know it.
And I think what it is, I walked onto the court in a drop-in session. Mm-hmm. Everyone just shows up and plays. And now, like Susan was saying, you look around and you try to take up every time of the day to find a partner to play pickleball with.
I was anxious to hit the court, but first, we had to go over some basic rules. And for that, I turned back to Aaron McHugh, author and self-proclaimed pickleball missionary.
It's a game to 11. You have to win by two. It looks a little bit divided up in three sections, really, like a tennis court.
Okay.
There's a section over each side of the net called the kitchen, which is 7 feet, which is invented the very first day of pickleball. In the 1960s. By the parents who were inventing it for their kids, to keep their kids busy. And the first day the people came over, there were two brothers, the Brown brothers and their dad, and they all evidently were 6'3". So they would be standing at the net and just whamming it over.
Damn.
You know, and the dads are saying, no. So they take their little shoe in the sand and make a line back 3 feet. You guys got to stand here if you're going to volley it from the air. Okay, that wasn't enough. 5 feet wasn't enough. It finally ended up 7 feet. And
overhead smashes.
No overhead smashes. You've got to wait for it to bounce to go in. So the kitchen is a little bit of a trouble area for everybody.
Okay.
And then there are two back quarters. So you hit it cross court, you know, to serve. Your serve is underhanded.
Mm-hmm.
Or I guess underhand. You can be underhanded.
I was just thinking
right?
that. Actually, I was like, is it though?
Grammar voice, right. We hope it's underhanded. And as the ladies were saying, it's sort of a minute to learn, a lifetime to master. But also, if you're not good, you'll get better. I swear to God, you can always get better at pickleball. It seems to me in a way that is very gratifying.
Yeah.
But also, people who are beginners will often stay with their other beginner groups, you know, and they're just enjoying themselves anyway. It's very kind. It's extremely inclusive. This is why I say I wish life were more like pickleball.
Yeah.
It's kind. It's inexpensive. It's inclusive. You play with people who are better than you, but you make sure you play with people who just want to start. You know, I got to be a little bit of a missionary. I want everybody to be experience the joy I find from pickleball, just like I do. So, you know, if I see you on the street, I'm going to make you come.
You say it's time to play. So here's the other thing about it, and I'll turn back to Susan Donahue and Susan Cronin on this. So about 4 years ago, I got a bad neck injury weightlifting, and it's been very hard to kind of go back to my old sports. Now I have an elbow injury because I have reached the age where the only thing that happens with my body now is injuries, right, as opposed to progress. And I have been intrigued because I'm not sure tennis is there for me anymore. Mm-hmm. How many people, can lots of athletes who can no longer do what they used to do potentially come to pickleball and do it instead, Susan Cronin?
Yeah, absolutely. I have restrictions on my shoulder. I never went through the surgery that Susan went through. Should, but now I can get away with it.
I don't
have the overhead serve anymore.
Yeah.
But I can get a lot of exercise and movement out of pickleball through just a smaller court, smaller surface. So, yeah, it provides all that.
And you almost always play doubles, which is helpful as well.
I was almost ready to play, but there was actually one more rule. Okay, it's not an official rule, but sort of an unwritten code that I needed to know.
And you know what's great is we always say, I swear to God, you often hear your very first day, you know, because we are a society that says that we're sorry for everything. Sorry if I bump you, sorry if I pass you, and sorry, when most of the time you don't mean it. Mm-hmm. And the first day of pickleball, you're playing with somebody, a partner who's maybe better than you, and you say they'll say to you right away, "There's no sorry in pickleball." And believe me, it takes some unlearning.
Women say sorry in every sport all the time.
That's right.
Say it. Yeah, we don't accept it on the court.
No sorry.
So there's no sorry in pickleball.
Yeah, everyone's trying their best, and let's get out and do it together. Mm-hmm.
And that was a lesson that took me a little while to learn.
Okay.
We always say it'll take about 12 minutes.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's good. See, no sorry. No sorry. No sorry, pickleball. Okay. Already. Okay.
Not to brag, but after just a few minutes on the court, I really felt like it clicked.
She's got it.
But maybe I was feeling a little too good because after a few more minutes.
Oh, they pickled us. Now we have to come. They pickled us 11-0.
Even getting beat by the Susans 11-0, I had a blast. And I started to get a sense of why this game has grown so much so quickly. But I asked Aaron McHugh what it is about pickleball that makes it so joyful.
When I was writing Pickleball is Life, which of course is the name of the book because that is my true belief. When I was writing it, I was lucky enough to find two of the kids who are now my age, of the dads who had invented it. Yes. And I said to both of them, what do you think it is? What is it? Because people say all the time, well, why is it so fun? And there's some ineffable something. I don't know what it is. But Bill Bell's daughter, said, you know, I think it's because anybody can play.
Yeah.
You know, there's now, you know, like, as I said, even if you're not good, it's okay. I played with somebody who's 92, a lifetime of tennis, and now he's great. But I also teach some girls at a school in New Bedford called Our Sister School, which is for financially challenged girls, grade 5 through 8. And I went to the head of the school and I said, I think the girls need a pickleball court. She said, build two, please.
Uh-huh.
I said, all right. So we went out in their crummy parking lot, built two courts. Now it's part of the fitness curriculum.
Well,
you
I
know?
Can see. It does make it, it's cardiovascular, it's muscular, it's,
you know, and strategic, it's strategic once you get the hang of it.
Yeah. Very much so. I mean, it's all angles and court position.
And so some of them are maybe not as good as others, and they don't seem to care. You know, it's fun.
So that's the other thing that I wanted to bring up. I was thinking about it while we were on the court. One, you are three physically accomplished women who have had to know how to be competitive, right? Two, in the time of COVID, we discovered at WBUR lots of different stories of ways that people were breathing out everything that was happening. So primal screams on football fields, axe throwing when it opened back up. There is even a place where you literally go smash things, right? Mm-hmm. What struck me in being on the court with the three of you is it was joyful, it was competitive, and yet it wasn't mean,
it's kind.
And it was supportive.
It's
it was
very kind.
Yes. And so I want to know, if I go five different places to play pickleball, will I find kindness in all five places?
Yes.
That is different.
I think so. Because there's what you'll find now about pickleball is there are a lot of indoor and outdoor open play. So you'll go to a place that has, say, four courts, and there's a whiteboard to sign up. Oh, I'm going to sign up with these three. And next time I'll sign up with these people, two of whom I don't know. And you try to stay, if it's an intermediate or an advanced, you know, group, and it says that, you know, stay in your lane.
Yeah.
Everybody's extremely welcoming. I've made so many friends that I had not expected to. And then that friendship has grown. And Susan Cronin is one, my new friend of mine.
So you guys met through pickleball?
Yes, through pickleball.
Absolutely. We met through pickleball.
You both, the Susans met through pickleball.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but these, everybody is so inclusive. And so I've met these people who have, as I say, have become friends with pickleball, but then suddenly I realized I'm doing other things with them in my very little spare time. But
is there para pickleball?
Yes, I have a friend named Mike, and he has polio. Mm-hmm. He's in his mid-60s, and he plays, and there's not a more joyful and welcoming person, and will play with every single person, as you can find in Mike Lipp. He went last year down to the national championships in Naples and came home with the silver.
That's
for
great.
Singles. Yeah,
that's
he's
great.
Pretty great.
Oh, wow.
It can bounce twice. The only really only difference is
it,
the ball can bounce twice. But I got to tell you, when you see four para pickleball players playing, not very often do they use the second bounce.
Erin wrote a whole book about what she loves about the game, but I wanted to throw that question to the Susans, starting with Susan Cronin.
What do you love most about it?
And the physical activity. So we keep ourselves, like I said, healthy, you know, just spiritually, together, and physically. And you get out there and you forget everything else that's going on in your day before and after. You're just out there enjoying with each other.
And other Susan, what do you love about it?
I have to go with the camaraderie also. You know, I have a son who's a Marine, and when we go down to Camp Lejeune to visit him, my husband and I bring pickleball rackets. And in the morning, before we're up playing with the grandchildren, we go out, and there's always a group of people out on the courts. And now they recognize us. And they say, oh, Susan and Dee are here.
Erin McHugh is author of Pickleball is Life, The Complete Guide to Feeding Your Obsession. Erin and I got pickled by Susan Cronin and Susan Donahue at PKL in South Boston last month. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.